The most mind-blowing number in computer science and mathematics is Chaitin's number. Today we talk to the man himself, Gregory Chaitin, about Chaitin's number.
Welcome to Mind Matters News, where artificial and natural intelligence meet head-on. Here's your host, Robert J. Marks.
Chaitin's number, one single number between zero and one, allows, under certain conditions, solution of every open problem in mathematics that can be disproved by a single counterexample. Many of these problems have large cash prizes for their solution. And we're talking today about the inventor of Chaitin's number, Gregory Chaitin, and we'll find out why, even though Chaitin's number exists, many of these cash prizes remain unclaimed. Professor Chaitin, welcome.
A pleasure to be here with you today, Bob.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I want to clear up something first of all. Stanford's Thomas Cover and Joy Thomas wrote a book that I used as a textbook for the graduate course in information theory called Elements of Information Theory. They refer to Chaitin's magical mystery number omega. And this is in a very thick scholarly book. They call your number mystical and magical. Now, of course, in your writings, you do not refer to this as Chaitin's number. You refer to it as a capital omega. Let me clear up something. There are people like Cover and Thomas that refer to this as Chaitin's number, whereas if you look at Wikipedia, they call it Chaitin's constant. Which one's correct, Chaitin's number or Chaitin's constant?
It's a little worse than that.
It's worse than that, okay.
Because you see, there isn't one halting probability omega. It depends on the computer programming language.
Exactly. So the Chaitin's number varies in accordance to the computer program you're using. So
right.
Therefore, calling it a constant doesn't seem to be appropriate.
But its bizarre or fascinating properties don't vary. As long as the computer programming language you pick is a kind of a universal Turing machine, which allows very concise programs, a general purpose computer, which allows very concise, the most possible concise programs. So you have to be a little careful what programming language you use, but there are an infinite number of programming languages, which will give you a bona fide halting probability omega with all the madness in it, or all the fun in it. So I think Wikipedia refers to Chaitin's procedure or something. Anyway, this is a quibble, I think. In fact, in my books, I actually settle the programming language. I use a version of Lisp to write an interpreter for the programming language that I take as the programming language I want to base the theory on. And then once you do this, it's a definite number with a definite numerical value that is maximally unknowable. By the way, in my first paper, I used a low-case omega. My first paper was published in the journal of this, and it was published in the Journal of the ACM in 1975. We've already, in a previous interview, referred to that paper and its title. I use a low-case omega. Omega is the last letter of the Greek alphabet. You know, at a church in Europe, you'll see alpha such a year, omega such a year. That's when they began building it. That's when they finished building it. And there's omega and a micron. Omicron is little omega, and omega is big omega. Anyway, Robert Salovey, who at that time was working at IBM when I wrote that paper where omega appears for the first time, he said, oh no, you don't want to use low-case omega because in set theory, low-case omega stands for the set of natural numbers, 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. So use a big omega. So henceforth, I took Bob's advice. He's one of the best set theorists in the planet. And it became capital omega. And I was sort of surprised that some people refer to it as Chaitin's number. I've even seen it in lists of important mathematical constants, you know.
Even though it's really not a constant.
It's not a constant. It's a number. Right, unless you fix the programming language, which I actually do in one of my books. And also, the other constants that they give, they give the numerical value up to a certain level of approximation. And mine is on that list simply because you can't give. Well, you can maybe get a few bits of the numerical value, but at some point it becomes unknowable.
Has anybody computed the first few bits of Omega?
Yeah, my colleague Chris Kalude with another professor at the University of Auckland have a paper, I think, called Computing the Bits of Omega or something. They pick a different computer than I do, but it's a good computer. It's a universal Turing machine, and it allows for the most possible concise programs. And they're able to determine, I don't remember, it was 40 bits of the number. And on the Leibniz medal that Stephen Wolfram gave me when I was 60 in 2007, on one side it has the face of a medallion that Leibniz wanted his Duke to coin in silver, which is about the binary arithmetic. Leibniz came up with binary arithmetic a long time ago. And he came up with the idea that the whole universe might be made out of information because he shows some addition, some multiplication. And he says, imago mundi, that's Latin for image of the world. And in the German version, it's Bildung or Schöpfung, something like that. I don't have much German, which also means image of the creation instead of image of the world. I think Leibniz intuited that it might be possible to make everything from zeros and ones. That's digital philosophy.
Digital philosophy, okay.
Digital philosophy, yeah, which is a philosophical idea that I like to toy with. So the other side of the Leibniz medallion that Stephen Wolfram was kind enough to give me as a present for my 60th birthday has Omega, big Omega on it. And it has some bits, the bits of the Omega number that Chris Kalude and his colleague were able to calculate and prove were correct. So that's a contradiction because in Latin it says the Omega number is something that you can't calculate. But at the bottom he gives some of the numerical value of one Omega number is given. So that's nice, a nice paradox, which is always good.
Well, here's a question that I have. I know that Omega, or Chaitin's number, is based on the foundation is the Turing-Halting problem, which says that there can be no program written to analyze generally another arbitrary program to say whether it halts or it runs forever. Wouldn't you have to, in a way, solve the halting problem for smaller programs in order to get Chaitin's number?
Yeah, well, if you had the first n bits of the in base 2 of the numerical value of the halting probability omega, from that it's very straightforward but very time consuming to solve the halting problem for all programs up to n bits in size. So in a way, the halting probability omega is a very compressed form of answers to individual cases of the halting problem. Knowing n bits of the value of the halting probability tells you for 2 to the n individual programs, all the programs up to n bits in size, whether each one halts or not, as it's easy to see. One way to put it, since, you know, from an engineering point of view, it's the maximal compression of the answers to individual cases of the halting problem.
Yes.
It's an irredundant representation. It's provably the best possible compression of all the answers of bits of the halting problem. Because you can, to solve the halting problem from all programs up to n bits in size cannot be done in less than n bits, so you get a paradox, and Omega does it in precisely n bits. So that is the best possible compression. It's like a crystallized essence of answers to the halting problem, the best possible irredundant compression of all the answers.
And even though a few bits have been computed of Chaitin's number, it is advertised as unknowable.
Yeah, because you can show that an n-bit program can't calculate more than the first n bits. And an n-bit mathematical theory can't enable you to prove what the more than the first n bits are. So it's logically and computationally unknowable. If the tool you're using has n bits, you're only going to be able to get at most n bits of the numerical value. And after that, all the rest, the infinite number of remaining bits, look just totally random and totally unstructured, and you'll never know them.
That's fascinating.
So it's fun. I'm surprised that it became such a hit in a way.
Well, but think about that. When you tell somebody that there are all of these open problems in mathematics that require a single counterexample, Goldbach's conjecture, Kolotz's conjecture, Legendre's conjecture, these are all problems with big prizes, mm-hmm. big monetary prizes. And you have postulated in theory a number, Chaitin's number, omega, a single number between 0 and 1 that solves all of these problems, at least in a philosophical realm. And that is astonishing. That is mind-blowing. That is something more extraordinary, as I mentioned, I think, in the first podcast, of any science fiction that I've ever read or watched.
Okay, well, that's great. I hope it will inspire young people to... Engineering is great, wonderful. I've worked as an engineer. You know, Elon Musk is my hero. But pure mathematics is also one of my loves, and maybe it'll inspire, Omega will inspire some young people to become mathematicians, pure mathematicians. And it may also give people an interest in philosophical questions instead of practical questions.
Yes.
There are always going to be a few of us who think, there are a lot of us who like to do things and practical things, and that's part of my personality too, but there's also... in me, a side that likes beautiful mathematical arguments and the fantasy world of pure mathematics, which has this strange number glowing there, the omega number. We do need some people who do pure mathematics with no applications, at least maybe not for 100 years. And we also do need some people who think philosophically. And I think omega is a stimulus. So it's nice to have this this number. I didn't expect it to catch on the way it did. I wouldn't say complicated because I invented it, but it takes a mathematical theory that is non-trivial, you know, to understand exactly how you define the number and why it has the properties it does. I thought the business that you can't prove that a program is elegant would catch on more. But people are interested in philosophical questions. And even though omega is sort of a unicorn or a flying horse, it's a mathematical fantasy in the Platonic world of ideas, it's caught on, which shows that we all have a taste for that kind of question too, which is good. You know, so it's the human spirit is capable of doing both things, right? Practical things and impractical things, which may become practical, have practical consequences later.
Yeah, I think the poster child for that is encryption involving large prime numbers and their factorization, which is used in most of the encryption that's used today. That was a mathematical theorem that laid around for a long time before somebody found out that, hey, we could use this for encryption purposes.
Yeah, who would have thought that G.H. Hardy loved number theory because he said it's purest of the pure, pure mathematics. He has a book that was shortly after, was written during the Second World War, I think. And he'd seen the First World War, and he hated things with practical applications because he said they would be used for carnage, for slaughter. So he said, at least there's one subject which will forever be as pure as the driven snow because it's totally impractical, which is number theory. So now it's used for cryptography, for sending military messages, probably. I don't know. It's used.
Oh, absolutely. Yes.
And it's used also for banks, right? Financial transactions. So Hardy would probably be very disappointed, but historically it's fun. It's the same thing happens with algorithmic information theory. At least for me, it was purely philosophical. I was interested in incompleteness. Solomonov was interested in more practical stuff, but it looked very difficult. And now, what is it? Algorithmic information theory goes back to the 60s, right? So what are we now? It's 60 years later. Hector Zanil and his collaborators are using practical approximations to this ideal theory and for practical applications. Oh, this is the biggest joke of all. The halting probability omega is totally unknowable. It's uncomputable, but you can calculate it in the limit from below. You look at more and more programs, you see which ones halt, and that way the halting probability keeps going up. Your estimate keeps going up. But it's very, very slow, this process. But in the limit of infinite time, you can calculate it in the limit from below. Well, the joke is that Hector de Zanil has proposed using this as a new cryptocurrency that he calls Otama Coin. And this is a serious proposal because he says that Bitcoin, right, which is the most popular cryptocurrency, uses an immense amount of computing power, really scary amount of computing power that didn't even exist before. But it's all going for this. It's not terribly useful computation except for this financial transactions, right? But what Hector Zanil has basically proposed is to calculate the bits of omega in the limit from below.
This
gives you a cryptocurrency. This gives you a cryptocurrency where the what you calculate is very, very useful. It's useful in the way that Marvin Minsky pointed out, that it tells you the best theories for things, the most concise programs for things. And that can be used for making predictions.
Well, you know, one of the interesting things about this, talking to George Gilder, who is kind of an economics guru and a forecaster of the future, says one of the problems with Bitcoin is the amount of value that you can get out of it is fixed. So there's only a certain amount of gold that can be mined from Bitcoin software. If we use the Omega number as a basis for a cryptocurrency, there would be no limit, would there? It would just get harder and harder and harder to mine the gold.
Right. The further you go, and the results of those computations are actually useful. Whereas in Bitcoin, you're spending a very, very large amount of computing power, right, mining Bitcoins. It's only useful for Bitcoins. It's not useful for anything else. So Hector thinks that's a terrible waste. At any rate, I think it's, I'm not terribly interested in practical applications, not when I'm thinking about mathematics and Omega and everything. But the fact that it's proposed as a new cryptocurrency, I think is fantastic. It's just a lot of fun. Who would have guessed?
It is really interesting.
But you have to wait 60 years, though. When I was publishing these papers, if I had to do practical work, I wouldn't have been able to do that research. 60 years later, this is practical research based on the Omega number.
Boy, that is just a fascinating, fascinating idea. You know, one of the, I think the poster problem for the Turing halting problem is Goldbach's conjecture, which says that every even number can be expressed as the sum of two primes. And if one had a halting problem or a halting oracle, if you will, you could solve Goldbach's conjecture very easily by looking for a single counterexample or showing that no counterexample exists forever. Do you ever think that Chaitin's number can be calculated to a precision which would allow for the proof or disproof of something like Goldbach's conjecture, which is a relatively short program?
It's relatively short as computer programs go, but there are a lot of programs up to that size. You know, it grows exponentially, so the calculation gets quite horrendous, and the algorithm that extracts that tells you, given the n bits of omega, that tells you for each of the programs up to n bits in size, which one holds and which one doesn't. If you do the obvious algorithm, its runtime is worse than super exponential. It grows as the busy beaver function of n. So,
oh gosh,
it looks tough. By the way, there's another interesting example of a famous mathematical problem called the twin prime conjecture. That there are infinitely many prime numbers that are two consecutive odd numbers.
Yes.
And it certainly looks to be the case. In fact, there are very good estimates that seem empirically validated formulas that tell you the distribution of twin primes, how many there are. Can't be proven, but there's a formula which gets more and more accurate the more twin primes you calculate. So it not only looks like there are infinitely many, but even we know the distribution, at least in the sense that an empirical scientist knows anything. But the question of whether there are infinitely many twin primes is not equivalent to a halting problem.
Yes, it can't be solved with a Turing oracle, could
it? Yeah, there's no finite counterexample. So you can't have a program searching for a counterexample. And then if the program doesn't halt, you know there is no counterexample. So Omega doesn't solve all problems. Now, there are extended versions of Omega. There's a hierarchy of Omegas that look at more and more abstract mathematical questions. So Omega wouldn't allow, knowing the bits of Omega wouldn't allow you to solve the twin prime conjecture, positively or negatively. But there's a thing called the jump of the omega number that sort of would. So you have omega, omega prime, omega double prime.
So omega prime assumes that you have a halting oracle.
Exactly. That's correct.
And so you have this omega prime that includes a halting oracle. But right. If you have a halting oracle, then you have to have a meta halting oracle that looks at regular computer programs with the regular halting oracle. So the Turing halting problem becomes more and more problematic. But in each case, you have a more and more sophisticated things that you can do with omega, which is just astonishing.
But you would need an oracle to do those things.
Yes, yes. And those are probably not computable. I'm wondering if there's any way to get a handle on what omega prime is.
Well, a colleague of mine in Buenos Aires, Veronica Becher, and I, mostly at her initiative, worked on omega prime and even on omega double prime. Another way to define omega prime is it's not the probability that a program will halt. It's the probability that a program will produce a finite amount of output instead of producing an infinite amount of output. These are programs that never halt or that may halt or may not halt. A program that halts obviously only produces a finite amount of output. So the probability that a program generated at random produces an infinite amount of output, amount of output is omega prime. And omega double prime is the, if you talk about programs calculating only 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, it's the probability that a program produces all but a finite number of the positive integers. So the whole, these are programs that calculate only 1, 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And the question is, the numbers that it doesn't calculate, will that be a finite number of numbers or will it be an infinite number of numbers? That's omega double prime. This was work mostly done by Veronica Becher and students of hers, but I participated a little bit in that work. And by now it's probably been generalized and extended in all directions, like happens in pure mathematics all the time.
Well, that's the thing. You know, omega itself is mind-blowing, but the fact that there's a regress into omega prime and omega double prime is hyper mind-blowing, if you will. And it goes on and on, doesn't it?
Yeah, well, this happens also, this hierarchy of things that are more and more unknowable. There's the normal computer, there's a computer that has an oracle for the halting problem. Then there's a computer that has an oracle for the computer that has an oracle for the halting problem. And it goes up and up.
Yes.
So this is related to it's a sort of a hierarchy like Cantor's theory of infinities. There's infinity of the integers, infinity of the reals. And for any infinity, there's a bigger infinity, which is the infinity of all subsets of the previous step. So you have a hierarchy, and dare I say that this is the notion, maybe, that you can only approach God in the limit. I think Cantor was interested in this question.
Well, in fact, I believe that Cantor attempted to make an audience with Pope Leo XIII, I believe it was Pope Leo XIII, about his theory of transfinite numbers. He never got to the Pope, but he got to one of his subordinates because he thought about the theological implications of his theory of infinite.
Absolutely, I regard Cantor's theory of infinities as a mathematical theology. It's beautiful stuff. It's also paradoxical, and apparently Cantor thought that God was speaking to him. He felt he was inspired. In a way, anyone who is creative sounds like God is speaking to us, right? In stuff in mathematics that I would say is discovered, not invented, you feel you're touching a reality beyond normal reality, right?
Yes.
And this is in that BBC Four 90-minute documentary, "Dangerous Knowledge," talks about this. It was funded by the Templeton Foundation, so it's a little
okay.
Daring.
I'm not familiar with this. What is the name of
Dangerous
it?
Dangerous Knowledge. If you go to my website,
Dangerous Knowledge.
It's on Cantor, Boltzmann, Gödel, and Turing. And for a while, it wasn't available on the web or anywhere else. But it is now on the web. I hope the fact that I put this on my website doesn't mean that they're going to be forced to take it down. But it's in 5 parts, and I give the links on my website with the original poster that the BBC4 used, this. I think it's a wonderful movie. The gentleman who made it, David Malone, actually went out to the places where all this work was done, to all these places, and also in some cases to the cemeteries where these amazing mathematicians or philosophers or theologians, whatever they are, physicists in case of Boltzmann, are buried. So maybe it's not obvious that when he talks about one of these thinkers, he's actually showing you where he worked and maybe where he's buried and things like that. So it's like a travel, it's like a mathematical travel documentary. It's quite a fun film.
I've always found that interesting. We know what these people do, but not who they were. And I think visiting the grave sites kind of tells us who they were.
I visited Gödel's and von Neumann's grave sites at Princeton.
You did? Oh, they're buried at Princeton. I didn't know that.
Buried in the cemetery that's a short walk from the Princeton University.
I see. Is Einstein buried there also?
Do you know? Einstein insisted that he be cremated and the ashes be scattered at an undisclosed location.
Really? Okay.
He didn't want to leave a shrine. I also visited Gödel's home, which is near the cemetery. It's in a poor part of town. Von Neumann had a home that I never visited, unfortunately. I only found out where it was. It's in the wealthy part of Princeton. And they're together in the same cemetery, rather close to each other. Anyway, I visited Gödel's home, and the people who were renting it from the current owner let me in, and they showed me things that were left there from when Gödel was the inhabitant. For example, he had soundproofing put in because noise distracted him enormously. And his wife had a shrine to the Virgin Mary in the backyard, which was still there. And in fact, their home was in the neighborhood, which when they bought the home were Italian laborers, people who did construction work, I think. It was in a relatively modest part of town. Gödel didn't marry a professor's daughter. He married a woman he fell in love with from comparatively humble origins, and I think she felt more comfortable. Also, it was a Catholic neighborhood, whereas Princeton, of course, is some form of high Protestantism, I believe, was at that time.
Yeah, well, certainly Princeton was founded on the Protestant ethic. So, mm-hmm. Yeah, and boasted of a number of evangelical presidents for a while.
Ah, that so, I didn't know.
Yeah. Well, that's true of a lot of the universities. They were founded based on Christianity, but they have strayed from that task as time goes on.
Well, two notable examples are Oxford and Cambridge. Oxford was for teaching priests, Catholic priests, and there was a schism, so a group went off and founded Cambridge.
Okay.
This was a long time ago, probably something like 500 years ago.
That's fascinating. Well, Professor Chaitin, this has been a delight talking to you. We've been talking to Professor Gregory Chaitin today about a number named after him. We also went into some other topics, but Chaitin's number, referred to as Omega, that's what he calls it, and Cover and Thomas in their classic textbook, Elements of Information Theory, referred to it as Chaitin's magical, mystical number Omega. We did not have the time to go into the details of Chaitin's number, but we will give some links to some of Professor Chaitin's lectures where he explains this incredible, mind-blowing number. And so until next time on Mind Matters News, be of good cheer.
This has been Mind Matters News with your host, Robert J. Marks. Explore more at mindmatters.ai. That's mindmatters.ai. Mind Matters News is directed and edited by Austin Egbert. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the speakers. Mind Matters News is produced and copyrighted by the Walter Bradley Center for Natural and Artificial Intelligence at Discovery Institute.